Welcome to the best of Great Australian Lives for Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives.
Hello and welcome to Great Australian Lives for Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives. I'm Laura Turner and tonight we bring you an encore airing of one of our favourite episodes from 2020. I hope you enjoy this conversation. Well, you'll likely know the distinctive voice of our guest tonight. He's one of the best storytellers in the country. He's been doing it for 40 years and does it with a dry wit that only he could get away with. He's a Walkley Award-winning journalist who has had unbelievable access to some of Australia's most notorious criminals. Think Chopper Reid or Mick Gatto, just to name a few. He is an icon of journalism and has now turned his famous tales into an enormously popular podcast called Naked City. It is my pleasure to welcome to Great Australian Lives, John Sylvester. How are you, Sly?
I'm good, Laura. How are you?
Very well, thank you. You're a busy man at the moment. How is the podcast going? How's it being received?
Yeah, look, it's really interesting for me. I was sort of slow off the mark as compared to others, but having done this for so long, I actually started to rat around and realised I had a lot of audio tapes from interviews that I'd done, which included a number with some notorious crooks. So that gave me the chance to sort of revisit these cases and go back to the original investigators, many of them who are now retired and therefore can be a bit more frank than maybe when they're in the job. So we've covered some pretty interesting cases, and I've just really enjoyed catching up with some of the old coppers.
It must give you a great sense of satisfaction to be able to flesh out the context and the extra detail that you might have not had the space for when the story was originally published.
Yeah, and you actually learn things along the way, like the one incredible story of Mick Drury, the undercover policeman from New South Wales, who was the victim of an attempted hit in his own home. He'd come to Victoria as an undercover and done a job here on a crook called Alan Williams. After the arrest, Williams knew that Drury was pivotal to the Crown case, so he went to a friend of his, which was a hitman called Christopher Dale Flannery. Flannery approached the notorious Roger Rogerson in an attempt to bribe Drury, and Drury wouldn't accept the bribe and said, "I'll give honest evidence." And as a consequence, they all got together and said, "Well, let's kill him." And to think that a serving member in Roger Rogerson would be complicit in the attempted murder of an honest colleague beggars belief. But I interviewed Williams many years ago, and he confessed exactly what happened and how it came to pass, including the role of Roger Rogerson. So I've got that
extraordinary
particular tape, and looking back on it, I didn't even really think, why would he talk to me? But it was actually what happened to Carl Williams that made all the sense, because what Alan was consistently saying is, yeah, I dobbed in Roger Rogerson, who was a crooked copper, but I didn't dob in any of my underworld associates. And it was just like Carl Williams, who was saying, oh, I gave evidence against a former police officer, so leave me alone. Well, it didn't work in Carl's case, and I don't think in the end it worked for Alan.
It is an extraordinary podcast. I've listened to most of the episodes, not that one, though. For those listening at home, let's have a listen now to the way it all begins with the podcast.
My name is John Sylvester. I'm Australia's longest-serving crime reporter and write a weekly column for The Age. Many of my colleagues have wondered why I've never bothered to move to other areas of the paper. The reason's pretty simple. I've got the best job in journalism, playing cops and robbers and getting paid for it. Over more than 40 years, I've covered some of Australia's biggest crimes and met fascinating characters on both sides of the law. In this series, you'll hear from them, the cops and the crooks, telling their stories. Welcome to my world. Welcome to Naked City.
Now, John, you say in the intro there that you have the best job in journalism. It hasn't been easy over the 40 years, though. As we know, print has faced enormous challenges, as all media has.
Online's really exciting because stories that you would be sitting on that didn't fit the print deadline, you'd get beaten on, even if you had the jump to begin with. And now, as soon as you can confirm a story, you can put it up. I think it's a glorious time to be in the game. Added to that, I always used to put jokes into my stories and sub-editors would laugh and then cut them out. Now, with so few sub-editors, they just don't have time. They've just got to put, no matter how bad the jokes are, they go in.
You are renowned for your humour. The segment on 3AW's Live the Underworld, that came from their days in community radio, didn't it?
Yeah, see, Ross had a program called Lawyers, Guns and Money on 3RRR, and it was absolutely mandatory listening for anyone connected with law enforcement. It was very dry and very funny. And one day, probably with a hangover on a Saturday morning, I was listening and Ross started to read one of my stories out, bagging it.
And this is a time he didn't know you, did he?
No, and he was bagging it as cliche-ridden, probably with some justification. And I rang up and Ross says that he thought it was going to be that typical, pompous journalism attacking him, but I sort of played the game a bit because it was rubbish what was written. And so he liked that and he invited me in a couple of weeks later, and then I co-hosted once. And then when Ross went to 3AK, he took some of these sort of regulars along, but it was so long ago that as a solicitor, he wasn't allowed to advertise, which is why he couldn't use his real name. And he decided that all the other regulars had to have nicknames or non-diplomes. So, you know, we had lunch a lot and the real estate guy was man in the tree. So I had to have a name, and that's where Sly came from.
I've always wondered. There you go.
It was a policeman who called me Sly simply because of the name Sylvester, as in Sly Stallone. And it stuck.
Yes, yep. And it's never gone away. All these years later, you're still... He's still doing it with the guys in the morning. It's great listening. I always want it to go for longer. I don't know how you feel, but I'm always disappointed when it finishes.
Well, it's great because it's really just a chat with friends, as long as you don't get too silly about it. I mean, I did get excited once and said of the gangster Alphonse Gangitano. I said, Alphonse John Gangitano has the brains of a flea and the genitalia to match. Which created some angst with...
That got you in a lot of trouble, didn't it?
Well, Al sued, which would have been a very, very interesting court case. However, he was shot dead before we could do battle in the Supreme Court.
Saved by the bullet for you.
And no one was ever charged, although the general belief is that it was his friend Jason Moran. And, of course, Jason himself was killed.
Yeah.
People have always had a fascination with true crime, whether it be books, movies, stories, or now podcasts. And in this one, you actually hear from those involved. Like, you know, we talked to one of the original Bikey Busters, and he tells the story of how the Hells Angels brought out an international hitman to kill two Victoria police. And they snaffled him in at Tullamarine when he got off the plane. And this fella, Jim Brandes, who is the coolest dude you've ever seen. If you can imagine those little sort of grandfather dark glasses that were very sort of hippie in the 70s and 80s. And he's actually, the photo I've seen of him is he's just in the cell at Tullamarine and he's just lifted his head up and he's looking at a policeman by the name of Bob Armstrong. Bob Armstrong looked a hell of a lot like Benny Hill, the comedian, and Brandes looked at him and said, God damn it, you do look like Benny Hill.
The character.
Yeah, so it's those sort of stories that we're trying to get at, the sort of stories that are told by, police and emergency service workers around the bar or dinner tables. And, you know, occasionally I have a catch-up with some old homicide investigators over, a cheap and cheerful pasta meal. And if you could put a tape on that, wow. You hear the real inside stories and the humour, which all people in emergency services need to survive. And
they have to have, yeah.
And the big advantage we've got is, of course, being connected with Nine, is that 3AW has been, incredibly cooperative, and they took all these old videotapes and cassette tapes and microcassettes and got them up to speed and digitalised them. Obviously, The Age has been really good, but Nine have been fantastic providing news broadcasts of the events and also using, you know, probably their best man to mix it.
I've got to say, Sly, I was listening to the episode about Christopher Binns, and I was actually outside that house for 3 days as a crime reporter, and I was very saddened to learn that my voice and my news stories were not... in your podcast. I was sitting there rubbing my hands together going, here's my moment, and then it didn't come.
Well, I think...
That was a great episode, though.
It gives you great insight into those sort of people. Chris Binns, as you well know, because you were there, he's inside a house. He's surrounded by police. He honestly believes they're going to try and kill him. He gives a sort of verbal will to his girlfriend. They put in a distraction bomb, which distracted everyone because it actually blew up half the house, tear gassed him. Mm. So he runs out deaf and blind with a gun and starts shooting. And the SOG shoot him with what's known as a beanbag shot, which is shot him in the chest, like getting hit by Mike Tyson, but it's supposed to be non-fatal. Well, he's wearing a ballistic vest, so he wouldn't know that. He would think they're shooting to kill him. He fires 5 shots, goes to the ground, gets up again, fires some more before he finally is grabbed. And they take his pulse rate and it's 80. So he's that calm under fire. It's just not normal.
He actually made a request, didn't he, in terms of the beanbag? He wanted one as a memento?
Yeah, he wrote to the SOG and critiqued their operation, suggesting what they could do better, which is so typical of Chris. And he asked for a beanbag shot. He didn't get it. But we talked to Kenny Ashworth, who had pursued Binns for many years, and it was a real insight into the relationship. You know, it's not that sort of black and white, and that they ended up both having a sort of grudging respect for each other. And when sitting in the interview room the first time, Binns is quite tense, and he said to Ken, well, when's it start? And he said, what do you mean? And he said, the bashing. He said, well, I'm not bashing you. I've got all the evidence I need. You're going to be charged. And Chris said that was the first time he hadn't been assaulted. As a consequence, he agreed to have a bit of an off-the-record chat, and he talks about stick-ups and how exciting they are. And at one point you can hear the ring pull of the beer cans in the background, that Chris is just having a couple of beers before he goes away. Chris did as hard jail time as anyone because he was such a good escaper. So he spent a lot of time in solitary. And on one occasion, when they finally tried to bring him out to mainstream, he went to a new division with his bag, and the prison officers were giving him the sort of instructions of how things worked. He said, don't bother. He put his bag down, went into his cell, put magazines inside his jacket to act like a stab vest, and went after an enemy that he'd been trying to get for 10 years, bashed him, and then walked up to the officers and said, well, you can send me back to solitary now.
Institutionalised criminal, if there ever was one.
A bloke very smart, at his best, very funny. He used to leave messages for the armed robbery squad in the public notice at the Herald Sun, with messages such as Badness is back, which was his nickname. And he bought a property in Queensland and called it Badlands.
I'm Laura Turner, and you're listening to the best of Great Australian Lives for 2020. More with journalist and crime reporter John Sylvester in just a moment.
You're listening to the best of Great Australian Lives for Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives.
And they got to that stage where they're doing 5 kilos a cook, so that's 10 kilos a week, 30,000, I think it was a kilo at the time. That's a fair bit of money, isn't it?
They started cooking speed regularly and made a truckload of money doing it. And they would have got away with it too, except for an elderly woman called Mrs. Smith, a grandmother who lived across the road at a farm. And she noticed all these young bucks turning up in hotted-up cars and contacted the local police.
You'd hear a Harley motorbike coming from a mile away.
Thank you.
And after a while...
I'm at Steele's house when I had a chat to him. That's his partner bringing me a cup of tea and a plate of biscuits. In the old days, it would have been a Palmer and Pot at the police club.
Welcome back to Great Australian Lives for Tobin Brothers Funeral, celebrating lives. Tobin Brothers now offer fully live-streamed services so that anyone who can't attend the funeral of a loved one can still view the services and participate. For more information, visit tobinbrothers.com.au. We are with John Sylvester tonight on Great Australian Lives. I love that bit of audio, John, that reference to the cup of tea and the plate of bickies that you're being served inside the home of an interviewee from the wife. It's real authenticity that we're getting from the podcast.
Yeah, look, the advantage of doing true crime is you don't have to make it up. I mean, the idea of that particular Hell's Angels lair. We've got a private schoolboy in Peter John Hill who takes to motorbikes and joins the Hell's Angels and decides he wants to know more about it and goes to America. And he's given the first Amphet recipe and comes back. In those days, cooking speed gave off a distinct odour. So you needed to do it in the country where it couldn't be smelled. And, of course, Mrs. Smith, across the road, contacts the appropriate police. And in the end, they're able to raid Greenslopes and do that particular speed lab.
From covering bikies' stories myself over the years, I've always been of the understanding, and maybe this is incorrect, that they try and look after their neighbours so that they don't get dobbed in, so that there's and so that the people around them feel comfortable and don't kick up a fuss when things are going down in the clubhouse. That's obviously not what was happening here with Mrs. Smith, though.
This was a discreet farm. They just chose it, believing they wouldn't be spotted. I mean, when it comes to clubhouses and things like that, yeah, that's right. You want to make sure the neighbours are on your side, and particularly that they won't allow the police to put any, cameras or... They couldn't go to Mrs. Smith and say, look, we're the Hell's Angels, we're not farmers, for fear of what would happen. And she was made of some pretty stern stuff. It was at a time where there was a chemical called P2P, which was readily available in Australia, but not in America. And P2P was used in the production of speed. Peter Hill used to send giant tins of Golden Circle, purportedly pineapple juice, but it was actually P2P, back to the mother chapter in America, where they made just millions and millions and millions of dollars out of that.
And I'm sure he earned huge brownie points with the mothership in America for doing that. I really felt for the investigators, though. You go into detail about how they were waiting for all four of the main players to be at the farm at the one time so they could nab them in the act. And I couldn't imagine how difficult it would be to, as they go into detail, get them all there at that one time and then pounce. It must have taken a lot of time and resources to get that happening.
Yeah, it did. And then they thought they had an open and shut case, and they were surprised, of course, when the first jury came back. It was a hung jury because one member refused to find them guilty. And it was only sometime later they realised that the Hell's Angels had nobbled the jury, and Peter Hill eventually, in a taped interview, which we've got, admits that they had one of their men on the jury and they were still cooking speed at the time.
Extraordinary. You've had so many stories over the years, John, as we know, and so many incredible, insightful tales. How did you decide which were going to make the cut and which weren't? It must be a painful process to leave some behind.
It started by saying, what have we got that's unique? You know, what can we give the listener that others can't? And that was some audio tape. You know, we've got people in those days, there were video records of interviews. So we've actually got people confessing to murders. And in the case of Phyllis Hocking, for example, that came together almost by luck. We had the interview of the grandson of Phyllis Hocking confessing to the murder, even though everyone knew that the real person behind it was Phyllis's son, Philip, who organised it to get the estate. So you've got the confession of the grandson, but there's also an unbelievable interview with A Current Affair with Philip, where Tanya Brown, then working for A Current Affair, interviews Philip, and it's a forensic interview. And you can just hear layer upon layer upon layer as Philip starts to realise he's not being believed, and you hear the inflection in his voice.
She's sort of letting him hang himself, isn't she?
And because he's a talker and he thinks he's the smartest guy in the room, he keeps talking, and you hear that high-pitched inflection where he's going, well, obviously I'd be the suspect because I've got the most to win, but I didn't do it. I have no interest in money. Well, of course, he got away with it because
he's trying to justify himself.
As soon as he the estate was cleared, he dumped his family, bought a yacht and sailed around the world and settled in New Zealand, where he died of natural causes. But we contacted the grandson just to out of courtesy, and he said, oh, no one's ever asked me what really happened. And I said, oh, yeah? And he said, well, yeah, I hit it, but I panicked and left because there were school kids outside. And he went on to explain that it was, in fact, his father who came back to deliver the fatal blows.
I found it fascinating, Sly, how open the grandson was about talking about that, how articulate he was in describing how he'd murdered his own grandmother. It was an extraordinary chat that you had with him.
It's sort of surreal, isn't it? You sort of forget what you're actually talking about when it's so matter of fact. And of course, we spoke to the original investigator, Charlie Bassano, who pointed out that on the victim's wrist was a watch which was smashed at a particular time, which would have looked as though that was the time she was attacked. But when they looked at the watch, it was rusted through. So why would she be wearing a watch that doesn't work, other than it was designed to be to look as though the attack happened at the exact moment that Philip Hocking was 700 metres away at a meeting with three other people?
I was fascinated by that, and just and I guess all criminals who get away with murder are able to plan things like this and think in that way. I couldn't believe that you would even think or know how to, you know, think ahead and put the watch on her wrist and think that's how you're going to get out of it, because it's frozen to that time. It's just obviously an intelligent but cunning man.
Yeah, and there was sort of telltale signs, like it was supposed to look like a burglary, but where the burglars went in was not the natural spot, and it was done in a way to do the least possible damage to the property. So just, you know, when you look back, you can link these things together. And it's really, you know, interesting to speak to some of the police who did these initial investigations.
When the grandson is speaking towards the end, and he talks about how he left the crime scene, but the police found it very disturbed, and there's blood splatters and things are smashed up and cables are cut. We're talking about the involvement of his father there. There was no insinuation that the father was involved in the actual murder, was there? He's come along later.
At the time, it was always believed that Brent had done the murder at his father's behest, with the father saying, "I will give you money out of the inheritance." So that the father organised it, but the grandson did it. It's only now that the grandson says, no, and he's not shooking. He's not saying, I'm an innocent man. He said, look, I deserve to do the 15 years that I did because I attacked her. And no problem, but I didn't actually do the fatal blow.
That's incredible.
Yeah, because he said the stereo gear was stacked up to make it look like a burglary. He said, well, I didn't do that, and I didn't disturb any of the rooms. The crime scene wasn't as I left it.
It's a fascinating episode. I want to touch just quickly, John, on you, aside from the podcast, little young John Sylvester, a little boy growing up. Did you ever dream that you would be the icon that you are today, the famous crime writer? Was journalism in your blood?
No. I like reading, but so what? I had no intention of being a journalist. Yeah. I went to uni and I did a double degree in drinking beer and sleeping in. And as a result, in my last year, my father started to nag me what he wanted to do. And I had absolutely no idea. And it was Chief Commissioner Mick Miller, his wife, Beverly, who said to me, because she said, you know, you should be a journalist because you've got an opinion on everything, which was a double-edged sort of comment suggesting I was a bit of a smart aleck. So I put in an application on the basis that I won't get the job and it'll get my old man off my back. And to my surprise, I did. And I walked into I had a giant blue with the panel, and I thought I'd stuffed it, but maybe they liked the fact that there was a bit of resilience there, because the bloke I was blueing with, who I nearly told to get nicked, he rang a couple of weeks later and said, you got the job. And he said, where would you like to work, the Herald or the Sun? And I said, the Herald, please. He said, well, you start on the Sun on Monday.
So in the end, they won.
I walked in and said to the editor, where's my office? And they burst out laughing. And I had I don't want to put you off, but I was wearing skin-tight flares and I had a gold pen sticking out, which was my 21st birthday present. And the world-weary editor looked me up and down and said, leave that at home, son. It'll get stolen. And I thought, you cynical old man. And 2 days later, it was stolen. So the first lesson was listen to your editor.
Yes. And I'm sure they still tell you that to this day, or try.
And I had no particular interest in doing crime. My father had been a senior cop, but I was pretty comfortable around police, but I don't think I was drawn to it. So I was just a typical lazy and incompetent intern in the big office, and I really thought I'd wash out at the end of the year. And then they, on rotation, sent me to police rounds, and that was up at Russell Street. And you worked, and I was working with a really dedicated group of people around my own age, and we became lifelong friends. And it was as much that that got me into it. And then once you got into it, it was fascinating. And a lot of journalists of the time were just looking for the next job, partially because they were looking for a new challenge, or partially they saw it as career advancement. I thought, this is pretty good what I'm doing here. And I was probably too lazy or stupid to ever look at advancement. I'm very glad I didn't, because it's given me the chance to see some of the most fascinating stories in Australia, and particularly Victoria, unfold over that period of time. And you also see amazing heroism and amazing dignity and people who rise to the challenge. So it's not all doom and gloom. A lot of it's inspiring.
This is Great Australian Lives for Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives. In these challenging times, Tobin Brothers offer a range of very practical solutions to help you plan a funeral and pay tribute to your loved one. For more information, visit tobinbrothers.com.au. And more with John Sylvester when we return.
He would turn to the detectives from crime and say, when Ashley and I were working together. And I said, hang on, Chris, hang on. We never worked together. You know, I wore the white hat, you wore the black hat. Let's get that very clear. Yeah, yeah, you know what I mean. But that 2.5 hours or so, it was just a laugh and a giggle show. And it was like, old home week with him. So, and then he fronted up to the Supreme Court, and he nodded, pleaded guilty to all the charges.
Chris decided to confess to all seven armed robberies from 1988, 89 and 91, worth $390,000. He told police, it's all or nothing, seriously. For me to make it right, it's got to be 100%. Which makes you wonder whether he was born bad or was twisted by a brutal upbringing.
Yeah, he's got a massive sentence. I don't know when he gets out.
Well, our guest tonight on Great Australian Lives is John Sylvester, award-winning writer and columnist and now podcaster. You've just heard part of one of the episodes of Naked City, which you can subscribe to wherever you get your podcasts from. John Sylvester is with me now. Now, that episode is about armed robber Christopher Dean Binns. We spoke a little bit about him earlier in the program, but I want to get into that a little bit more. You examine the issue of mad or bad, especially with relation to Christopher Binns. He called himself badness, of all things. Having dealt with so many people like him, do you have an idea on mad or bad? Do you think people can be born bad, John?
There's both. There are really, really lovely families that just have one rotten egg. And often we don't know. Sometimes, you know, we've had experience of going through royal commissions showing abuse and of people in care, and it is really chilling to see how many of our serious crooks, the really violent, the really dangerous, who were at different times in care and abused. I have no doubt that the Russell Street bombing would not have happened if certain people hadn't been treated so badly when they were kids. And some of them, they don't even know why they do it. I remember speaking to the then head of the homicide squad many years ago about a particular serial killer and saying what an evil, despicable person he was. And he said, well, I actually feel sorry for him. He said, he's just built wired wrong. You know, these deep, dark, dreadful compulsions he's got, he'd rather not have them. He can't stop. He said, I actually detest paid hitmen, people who have dinner with their family and then for money go and take somebody from somebody else's family, particularly somebody like, anti-drugs campaigner Donald Mackay, who is just a really, really decent man whose body was never found after he was killed in Griffith. You know, somebody did that and just went home and played with the dog.
Have you ever been fearful for your own safety, given the interaction that you've had? You know, you've been inside the homes of some of our worst criminals, you've had relationships with them, you write about them. It's a very fine line to walk, isn't it?
Look, it'd probably, for publicity's sake, be great to, you know, talk about great threats. But, you know, while we're talking now, there will be young uniformed members checking on, you know, factories and walking into dangerous situations. It's much more dangerous to be a young copper than an old journalist. A lot of the crooks that I've written about are quite egotistical and they like to see their names in print. My writing colleague Andrew Rulon and myself, we did a book called Tough, 101 Gangsters, and we did it all seriously with an index at the back with the name and what pages they were on, and people started to think we were finally taking ourselves seriously. But really it was only designed so that every crook could flick at the back and see that they were in it. And we knew that any one of them named would either buy or steal 10 copies and that would pay for the print run.
That was it our most shoplifted book?
I think Chopper was the most shoplifted, which meant that they
Chopper.
They had to put Chopper at the front of the bookshop in a prime position, which helped it sell because it was getting stolen if it was down the back. Mark always really wanted to be, he was never going to be the best crook, but he wanted to be the most famous. And, of course, in one way he did, because he had a series of best-selling books and the movie with Eric Banner. And Eric Banner's performance was remarkable because Eric went down to see Mark, who lived in Hobart at that time, and only had, I don't know, an hour, 90 minutes with him. But when he came back, he had him down pat. His walk, his talk, his sense of humour, it was perfect, and everyone loved it, except Mark, who said, the trouble is Eric Banner does a better chopper than I do.
He did a brilliant chopper. You've had so many encounters with these sorts of people, and you've covered so many huge stories in your time, John. Is there a cold case or a story that sticks with you that you would like to see resolved that hasn't been yet?
Look, there are several murders of which I've come to know the families. And in those particular cases, I've really, really decent people. You know, people talk of closure. It's nonsense. For many of them, particularly as they get older, there's a real increased desire for some form of resolution to know what has happened. And we're blessed here is that we actually have a cold case unit or squad. The work they've done is quite phenomenal. And in most jurisdictions of the world, if you haven't really got a handle on this in about 5 days, that's it. And we have successful cases where police have gone back years and years and years. There was a case out here, it was out at Nuttawatty, a young man who came from a lovely, lovely family, and he just got into selling cannabis because he could. And in normal circumstances, he probably would have been caught and given a warning and got back on the straight and narrow. But on this occasion, he was murdered for the cash he was carrying, and that looked as though it was going to remain unsolved for many forever. Eventually, police issued a reward, but they had a little bit of grainy footage of someone leaving a phone box. That's how odd the case was. The a call had been made to James, the young man who was killed, and they thought, oh, we'll just release that so that the particularly TV's got something to run with. And they got a phone call within hours saying, well, I know who that is. He's got a peculiar gait. He went to school with us, including James. And ultimately, that resulted in a conviction. So his family at least know what happened. And that's it is incredibly satisfying for the police to do that sort of thing. And there's been sting operations as well where they've stopped murders. And there was one that sticks in the mind where a policeman said, this is the best day of my life. And that was an executive who had planned to kill his wife. And they used an undercover police officer as the so-called hitman. And the guy who was organising the murder actually practised what he would do when the police knocked on his door to say his wife was dead. So he rehearsed time and time again because they had a listening device in the place and they could hear him. And eventually the police knocked on the door and said, "Sir, we've got terrible news." And he gasped. And the guy said, "Your wife's alive and you're under arrest."
How satisfying for the police.
Yeah.
This is Great Australian Lives for Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives. In these challenging times, Tobin Brothers offer a range of very practical solutions to help you plan a funeral and pay tribute to your loved one. For more information, visit tobinbrothers.com.au and more with John Sylvester in just a moment.
You're listening to the best of Great Australian Lives for Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives.
Tobin Brothers now offer fully live-streamed services so that anyone who cannot attend the funeral of a loved one can still view the service and participate. For more information, visit tobinbrothers.com.au. Our guest tonight is John Sylvester, award-winning writer, columnist and now podcaster. You can subscribe to his new podcast, Naked City, wherever you listen to podcasts. It entertains me every time I listen, John, to hear you say that if you don't like it, shut up and don't leave a review. That is your trademark humour right there. Has anyone left a bad review? Have they all shut up?
As you know, you shouldn't read reviews, but I'm new at it, so I do. And they've been really nice. People have been very generous in regard to it. You know, there is a real market. People want to know about this, but I think when you actually hear from the real crook, rather than just a review of the facts, you actually, even when it's a bit grainy or gritty and not the best quality, to actually hear from Chris Bintz or the bikie Peter Hill or from the drug dealer Alan Williams, or to hear an old policeman like Brian Murphy saying that he grabbed Williams and tried to bite his nose off, it's pretty frank stuff.
Can you give us a hint as to what we might expect in the upcoming episodes?
There's one that's going to be totally different, and that involves Nine as well, and that's David Key, who was part of Police Rescue. And 400 times he was lowered out of a helicopter to rescue people, and he was part of the team that went into the Sydney to Hobart. We're talking 100-foot waves and how the helicopter nearly crashed. And then you think that's enough, and he turns up at Black Saturday. And it's actually the Channel 9 helicopter that radios the police helicopter and say, "Look, there's people down there." And they lower...
Yeah, I remember that.
..him down into this hell, and he thinks he's going to die, and then they cut him off because the helicopter is likely to crash with all the, you know, the currents and the thermo. So he's down there in the middle of a bushfire in the very area 11 people were killed, and the police helicopter said, "Get in the car, we'll direct you out." And so this ragtag army of people and horses and dogs directed out, and David says that at one point he looked out the window and the horse they're leading, the mane is on fire. So he grabs a bottle of Pepsi Cola and puts it out, and they survived. So it's not only crooks but also dead set heroes. It just shows you that policing is just not about the baddies.
Absolutely. I've spoken to that officer before. That is an incredible story. I can't wait to hear that episode with your take on it and your expertise. Thank you for being on the show, John Sylvester. It has been an honour and a privilege. Thank you.
Thanks, Laura.
John Sylvester there on Great Australian Lives. In these challenging times, Tobin Brothers now offer fully live-streamed services so that anyone who cannot attend the funeral of a loved one can still view the service and participate. For more information, visit tobinbrothers.com.au.
You're listening to the best of Great Australian Lives for Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives.